Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
As we turn the page on the first year of COVID-19, the number of people infected and the number of people hospitalized continue to rise. Now, more and more people who did get sick are experiencing symptoms long after they should have recovered. Today, Coin Digital reporter Amanda Arden is here to explain who a long hauler is, why their fight is so hard, and who they lean on to survive. I'm Ian Costello. It is Thursday, December 10th, and you are listening to the Coin Podcast Network coverage of the coronavirus pandemic. Amanda, this is the first time you've been around on the Coin Podcast Network. Tell me a little bit about what it is you do at Coin.
I'm a digital enterprise reporter. Most of what I produce is primarily for the website. The enterprise part of the title means I get to work on stuff for longer. So like the story that we're discussing today, I began it back in October.
Amanda, it used to be when I heard the phrase long hauler, my mind went to semi-trucks and trailers carrying cargo across the state or across the country. But since you started working on this story, I've been fascinated with this term when it comes to COVID-19. Who are we talking about when we say long hauler?
A long hauler in terms of COVID-19 is someone who is experiencing symptoms from the virus for longer than the usual 2 to 3 weeks. So CDC research, at least the latest that I could find, shows that for most COVID-19 patients, 65%, their symptoms resolve within that 2 to 3 week window. But there's 35% of those surveyed who say their symptoms are lasting longer than that, for weeks or even up to months. And this is a relatively new virus, so it's really hard to say how long the symptoms will truly persist.
We're talking about a third of the people who they talked to who had gotten coronavirus weren't seeing a resolution to their symptoms in that usual 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah, more than a third. And to give you some perspective, people who get the flu, only about 10% experience symptoms that persist longer than 2 to 3 weeks.
Let's talk a little bit more about those symptoms. Early on in the pandemic, most of the coronavirus symptoms we were hearing about were respiratory. But in doing your research here, you found that the persistent symptoms long haulers are suffering are a bit different.
Yeah, Ian, the women I've spoken to have described so many symptoms, such a wide range. Some of the more mild ones include things like GI issues, hair loss, dizziness, headaches, brain fog. That's a big one that we hear a lot about when we talk about long haulers. Fatigue and inner ear pain. They get worse. Some of the worst symptoms I've heard of are one woman describes she feels like she's having a heart attack. Another woman says she's developed high blood pressure, nerve pain, severe depression, and even something called COVID onset glaucoma. And this doesn't even begin to cover everything that the CDC is reporting. I mean, there are cardiac issues, wide array of respiratory issues, even dermatological issues.
I want to talk a little bit about these long haulers you met, and let's start with Jennifer English. When did she first get sick?
So Jennifer first realized she was sick on April 4th, and it was a classic scenario we've been hearing about pretty frequently since this virus surfaced. She said she had made tacos that night for her and her son.
April 4th, we had sat down for dinner, and I took a bite of my taco and was really disappointed that it was so bland. And I said something to my oldest about it. And he said, no, mom, these are really good. And right then I knew, because I'd already been kind of, you know, seeing on the news that loss of taste was one of the symptoms. So I absolutely knew at that point.
Soon after, she started experiencing horrible symptoms. But because her fever wasn't above 103 degrees and her oxygen levels weren't low enough, she wasn't admitted to the hospital. They wouldn't admit her. So she just was left to go home and self-isolate with the hope that her symptoms would improve.
That was back in April, and she's still not healthy. How is this affecting her daily life?
So she spent about 74 days in isolation, actually. So most of the time they tell you to go home and quarantine for 2 weeks. She did it for over 2 months. Her symptoms weren't getting better. To give you a sense of who Jennifer is, she is a previously healthy 46-year-old woman. She's a single mom who lives in Oregon City. Before getting COVID, she worked 2 jobs ran marathons, and in her free time was restoring a travel trailer from the 1960s. So she's a very active woman. And now she says it's hard for her to even get out of bed and walk a couple blocks.
I have no motivation whatsoever. I'm so tired and have lack of energy so bad that I'm only able to get up, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day and do stuff. Then I'm right back in bed again.
When I spoke to Jennifer in November, she said that morning she had to push our interview back because she woke up that morning and couldn't stop vomiting. She said she's still extremely dizzy. Often she sees flashing in the corner of her eye and has leg spasms. She's described to me that she feels like she has dementia.
I forget so easily words. I forget what I'm doing. I emptied the dishwasher the other day and I put all the clean bowls into the refrigerator and didn't even realize for, you know, hours till I was like, where are all the bowls at?
She's been sick since April. You said she couldn't be admitted into the hospital because her fever wasn't high enough and she wasn't suffering some of the severe symptoms of COVID. Amanda, do you get the sense from the people that you've talked to doing this story that they might be struggling to convince their doctors that they are still sick so long after their original diagnosis?
Absolutely. Jennifer's told me she's also gone to the emergency room before when she's felt like she's having a heart attack and they've told her to go home. And other instances where she says she just feels like her doctor doesn't get it or her doctor doesn't believe her. You know, she understands that there's just not a lot of research out there for doctors to use. And she's actually ending up kind of having to do her own research.
So I went online and started researching everything on my own to try and figure out what was going on.
Another long hauler I spoke to from Pendleton, her name is Carrie Rodriguez. She seems to be having better experiences with doctors. She says she has a very good primary care doctor who has believed her this whole time, has sent her to a neurologist in the Dalles. She's having a good experience with her doctor, still kind of encountering a lot of obstacles where they don't exactly know what's going on.
It's just, it's unbelievable what I'm going through at 35 years old, previously a healthy person. I didn't even take vitamins before. I was healthy. I was still at the prime of my life. I feel like I've lost who I used to be.
I've also inquired about what this is like when treating these patients. Doctors just don't have all the answers. And they say that that's just as frustrating as it is for patients who are expecting them to have all the answers. Dr. Akram Khan from OHSU said it can be very hard for doctors to understand subjective symptoms. And that's things like pain and discomfort. There's no way for them to measure those things. So when they run tests on patients and they come back normal, it's not necessarily that doctors don't believe them. It's just really, really hard to figure out what's wrong with them.
What I try to remind patients is that, one, our own human lack of understanding as providers, it's very frustrating for me when somebody's not getting better and I don't have the answers. It traumatizes me as much as it is traumatizing the patients that we don't have a good answer for why they are not getting better. And we try to work with them and we try to provide support to them as a human being, just so that they understand that we are here in it with them. And while we may not have an answer now, we may have an answer later.
As you were learning more about Jennifer, she thinks she's kind of alone in trying to figure this out. She talked to you about doing her own research and presenting that information to her doctor to try and help kind of move the conversation along. Can you talk a little bit about the community Jennifer has found through Facebook?
A mutual friend connected Jennifer with a woman named Diana Barrett, and she's a co-founder of this group called Survivor Corps.
Survivor Corps is what has become the largest grassroots COVID movement in the country.
Diana was actually one of the first in the New York City area to contract COVID-19. And while she was in isolation, she developed this group.
So, you know, we've really been the canary in the COVID coal mine from the beginning. So we start to see things at the very beginning. And I realized that if I was going to get through it, there were going to be thousands to follow. I had no idea there would be millions to follow.
Initially, her goal for this group was to kind of create what she calls an army of survivors. And she wanted to mobilize them to participate in research and donating plasma and just being any help to scientists that they can possibly be. what this group has mostly turned into is a support group just for survivors of this virus or people who are still dealing with symptoms.
This is not a group that I wanted to see grow to the number that it has, but I'm glad that it's there to offer people the support that they need. They need information, they need support, they need the camaraderie of other people who understand.
So Jennifer said she logged onto the Facebook page after spending 10 days in isolation. She said she had been feeling so alone, and as soon as she logged in, she realized she was not alone. She started posting in there saying that her symptoms weren't improving over time and realized that other people were going through the same thing. And they've all started speaking up and sharing what works and what doesn't work with doctors and their latest discoveries.
We've got these long haulers still suffering months after first contracting the coronavirus, and this effort to really understand what is going on with them and how to heal is being hampered by our recent terrifying spikes in new COVID cases and hospitalizations.
Yeah, this is something Dr. Akram Khan, the OHSU pulmonologist whom I spoke to, emphasized. He said scientists and researchers across the U.S. essentially dropped all of their projects that they are working on, and they're focusing all their energy on finding a way to stop the spread of the virus. With hospitals filling up, doctors are overwhelmed, and it's really difficult for them to find time to study this post-COVID-19 syndrome.
I think right now, with the increasing number of cases and the number of patients who've been infected, the system is currently overwhelmed that we are not set up to provide this to all the patients who are suffering from COVID-19 across the country.
But because they're so occupied with current patients and so focused on stopping the spread, they just don't have much time to figure out what's causing these long-lasting symptoms in some patients. Dr. Khan was the one who really stressed to me that he believes the most progress they'll be able to make is after a vaccine is developed and they have time to focus on the long-lasting symptoms these patients are seeing.
While these long haulers keep dealing with these long-term complications courtesy of COVID, can you give me a sense of what treatment they are getting? Are these people getting help with the headaches and the cognitive impairment and the dizziness, those things that Jennifer and Carrie described as having to deal with on a daily basis?
Carrie has told me that they finally found the right concoction of medication to control her high blood pressure, and that she's actually taking an epilepsy medication for her migraines and to get some relief for the nerve pain she's been experiencing.
I feel like science will catch up. I don't know if I will ever be back to where I used to be. I'm realistic. I know that some of the conditions that I have are lifelong conditions, but I'm also optimistic treatments are going to help.
I spoke to a pulmonologist from UC Davis, and he said other doctors are trying to use methods that work for other illnesses to treat COVID-19 patients. For example, he studies COPD and COPD patients a lot, and so he's trying to use methods that work for those types of patients and implement them to help COVID-19 patients who are experiencing respiratory illness, scarring in their lungs, damage to their lungs, stuff like that.
An example is when someone's out of breath, right? The lung always gets blamed. That can be your heart. That can be deconditioning. That could be all of the above, and it often is. So we're kind of really having a systematic approach of both labs and studies, but also questions and approaches we have to the patients.
Dr. Kuhn, he was really stressing that patients who are experiencing these symptoms, he wants them to come to clinics like the one at UC Davis or the one at Mount Sinai, or there are other ones too. I believe the Cleveland Clinic has one. There are others in California. He's stressing that it's important for long haulers to make contact with doctors at these post-COVID clinics because they're the ones that are really studying patients like this. And they're looking for patterns and they're looking for things that work in other patients that they can implement then in others to try to help them.
The hope is if we see enough people, then we can start finding trends, right? And that's really what kicks off science, right? You see a cluster and say, here's something that hasn't been described. Here's a group of people. We have this scientific backbone so that we can quickly kind of pivot to say, okay, we're going to check, whether it's a basic science study or a clinical study, right? This is what kind of kickstarts really getting answers, is participating in this research so we can actually have tools that can apply. So that's what I'm hoping for the clinic is once we start seeing enough people that we can kind of really start, helping fast forward the research wheels a bit.
I wish I could say that mysteries are being solved, but it looks like that's just not happening yet.
So for now, the long haulers you talk to, Jennifer and Carrie, are left waiting and in a large part left to rely on each other for support.
Yes, they're relying on each other for support and also answers. And they're not just supporting each other through physical illness. I wanted to make sure I emphasize this. They're really supporting each other through mental illness as well. Jennifer has told me this virus and its ongoing symptoms have taken her to her lowest of lows.
When my symptoms persist for 2, 3, 4 weeks again, and I don't get that little break in there, I lose hope. I wonder, you know, why am I doing this? Why am I still fighting if it's just going to be like this for the rest of my life?
But she said people in the group have saved her life and they continue to bring her back.
It's meant the world to me. It's made such a huge difference and such a huge impact. I tear up when I think about it that in that sense, because I don't know what I would have done without them. I was basically alone in my bedroom for 74 days, and you can only watch so much Netflix, unfortunately. These people, these wonderful people, I owe them my life.
And I think there's an overall determination among long haulers that they don't want anyone else to go through what they're going through. They're really optimistic that science will catch up eventually, hopefully sooner rather than later, and they're willing to do whatever they can to help protect others from ending up in their situation.
Thank you very much, Amanda.
You are welcome.
That will do it for us today. Thank you for listening to the COIN Podcast Network. We will talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to this presentation from the COIN Podcast Network. Here's another podcast you might want to check out right now.
There's one story that haunts me.
Ken Martin was 54 years old. And then there was Barbara Martin, who was 48. The oldest was Barbie, followed by Virginia, and then Susan, who was 10.
A father, mother, and three daughters have vanished.
The primary theory at the time was that it was an accident. Both girls had holes in their skulls.
When we find the car in the Columbia River, we will find the Martin family and we will solve this case.
To hear more great podcasts, head to coin.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.